boldly searching for your next used vehicle? With CarMax, you don't have to settle on anything when it comes to your ride. Instead, steer clear of the ordinary and buy the car that's right for you. Because CarMax makes it easy to stop settling and find a car you'll love today. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What the Funk is brought to you by the Functional Medicine Coaching Academy. The information we provide is for educational purposes only and not intended to diagnose or treat any medical condition. What works for one person might not work for you, so please talk to your doctor before you make any changes. And heads up, this is a pretty funky podcast. Some episodes contain conversations and language that might be better suited for adult ears. And now, here's What the Funk.
Hi, I'm Laura. I'm a certified functional medicine health coach and longtime health nut.
And I'm Clayton. I'm just your average garbage human that woke up after a series of unexplained health problems and realized I have to do something about this.
So using my skills as a health coach
and my desperate need to get healthy,
we embarked on a journey of healing and accountability that brought us here today.
So join us as we talk to each other and some leading health experts breaking down the truths about functional medicine.
Some folks call it quackery, some might say it's fake news.
Those of us that practice it no longer sing the blues.
There's a missing part of medicine that needs to be debunked.
We've got the A's if you've got the Q's. So welcome to What the Funk.
Naturepedic is our sponsor.
Naturepedic organic mattresses. We love curling up in our Naturepedic organic mattresses.
I love rolling around on my Naturepedic mattress topper.
Enough rolling around here. Let's get to the point.
No, look, if you are in the market for a new mattress, and I know you hear about mattresses all the time on podcasts, but this one's different.
This is a
bed that gets delivered to your house, but it's completely organic.
Yeah, it's made out of like organic cotton, organic wool, organic latex. It's GOTS certified, Global Organic Textile Standard.
Right. We spend a lot of time in bed. Let's face it, during this current time, we spend most of our time in bed. So why not be sleeping on something that's like actually good for you?
Yeah, where you're not breathing in fumes. We're breathing in so many fumes anyway,
right,
on a day-to-day basis. Let's not breathe it in from our mattresses.
And because Naturepedic is so amazing, they have given a discount to our listeners.
Yep. Go to naturepedic.com and enter the code WHATTHEFUNK with a C15 for 15% off all their products.
So go get it.
Yeah. Toxin-free is the way to be. Naturepedic, they guarantee.
I love your face after you're like, what do they guarantee?
Toxin-free.
Great. All right, on this episode of What the Funk, we take a detour, so to speak. Do we?
I mean, look, we're theater people. Clayton and I met doing a play, and today we're going to talk to two other theater people.
Well, not just theater people. They're like Broadway royalty.
They're Broadway royalty. Sandra Joseph and Ron Bohmer. They met doing Phantom of the Opera. And Sandra's the longest running Christine Daae, the longest running leading lady on Broadway. She did it for over 10 years.
That's incredible.
Amazing.
And like, if you don't know about theater and you've never been to a play ever, what happens is you do the same show over and over and over and over and over again. Usually like out here in LA, a run will last anywhere from like 4 weeks to like 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not doing 8 shows a week. You're doing 4 a week, maybe.
But on Broadway, you're doing usually 8 shows a week. And in the case with Sandra, she did that show for over 10 years, 8 shows a week. And Ron did the Book of Mormon for over 7 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's a very long time to be telling the same story and doing the same track over and over again. So it's like, how do you keep that fresh?
Right. So I did math in my head. Just kidding. I did it on my phone. That's almost 3,000 shows a year.
Wow.
So if you do 3,000 shows a year times 10, that's 30,000 shows. So how can you say the same thing 30,000 times, not including rehearsals and pickups and put-ins?
Oh, my God.
Keep it fresh. That's what we wanted to investigate in a way.
And I was trying to make this connection to, you know, where we are right now in our lives. And Clayton was like, all right, don't push it. But I do feel like there is a sense of, like, right now we're all kind of more, in a sense, like going through the same routine every day because we can't go out and do the things that we might normally do and have the adventures that we normally would.
Right.
So how do we keep that fresh? How do we wake up every day and really find that sense of new creativity and purpose in what we're doing?
Right. And how, but also like it's the Phantom of the Opera, which is all about the Phantom who wears a mask. And we literally wear masks every day.
I know. We have to unmask.
We have to unmask.
Sometimes.
But how, but this is the name of my next book. How do you unmask when you're literally wearing a mask?
That is deep.
Isn't that deep?
It's deep. But Sandra actually did write a book called Unmasking What Matters, 10 Life Lessons from 10 Years on Broadway.
Amazing. And we just kind of like, we had some fun talking to some theater people. To us, I felt like we were talking to like mentors in a way.
Yeah, totally. And they're also the first couple that we've talked to on the podcast. So that was fun too, to talk to two people at the same time. And they're an amazing couple also. Like they're really supportive of each other.
Yeah. And to get to ask someone who is essentially doing what you want to do, mm-hmm. like these great careers, just to dig in and ask them questions. I think it reveals a lot of stuff just about humanity and about people. And I've always thought that what actors do and the amount of resilience that actors have to have is such a great lesson and such a great example that
for
everybody.
Yeah. And yeah, resilience obviously is such a huge part of what we all need to really tap into right now, but also like the adaptability and flexibility and how to shift focus and shift perspective.
How to do a triple turn when I'm just coming off of singing a high G.
Exactly. These necessary life skills that we all need.
I'm like, why am I doing a jante when I should be doing a split?
Because the director told you to do a jante.
And then we talk about that. Like there's, it's all in the pot. We're just like saying what we're going to talk about in the interview. But I do want to talk about the note thing because we were talking about getting notes. So when you're in a production, you get notes usually from the director, sometimes from fellow actors. And it's so interesting how we take criticism because it's not that I can't take criticism. I can take criticism. But when someone gives me a note, whether it's about my acting or my writing, I just immediately go to like fight or flight. Like at this defense.
You get defensive.
I get defensive.
Yeah.
Even if I know it's a good note.
Right.
Something in me just lights up and it's just me, you know, like I feel like if someone gives me a note, it means I didn't do a good job. So instead of being sad, I turn to like kind of like anger or like getting aggressive.
Right.
But you know, I'm just working on trying to not be reactive in those moments.
Yeah.
And honoring that that's why when I get notes, especially if I'm in a production and someone's like, you know, can you do this? I literally just go, yes, of course, thank you. And then I decide later if I'm going to do it or not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I'm not going to let my reaction in that moment be anything because it's going to be the wrong reaction.
Right. No, I've noticed that. You're doing the work.
I'm doing the work.
And, you know, I feel like for me, I'm learning how to not just blindly believe everything that someone tells me.
Right.
You know, so Joe Schmo on the street tells me I got to do a triple jante. You know, I don't have to do a triple jante.
You don't have to do a triple jante unless the choreographer or director tells you to.
Exactly.
Anyways, so tell us more about our guests we're talking about today.
Okay. Sandra Joseph is a history-making Broadway star, a number one international Amazon best-selling author, and a keynote speaker. Her legendary run as Christine Daae in The Phantom of the Opera spanned 10 years and earned her the record as the longest-running leading lady in the longest-running Broadway show of all time. She's been seen on numerous national broadcasts, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, yes, CNN, The Today Show, Dateline, The Early Show, The View, and Oprah, Where Are They Now? Sandra is on a mission to empower other people's voices. Her one-of-a-kind musical keynote programs inspire audiences to become world-class performers and unmask what matters most in their lives and careers. And her TED Talk, Fall in Love with Fear, is amazing. Watch it. She's also the author of Unmasking What Matters, 10 Life Lessons from 10 Years on Broadway. And she is the co-author with 5-time New York Times bestselling author Caroline Miss of Your Creative Soul, Expressing Your Authentic Voice. Sandra is married to her co-star from The Phantom of the Opera, actor Ron Bohmer. Ron Bohmer is a Broadway legend. He has been in so many Broadway shows, including Phantom of the Opera as the Phantom, The Book of Mormon as Jesus, among others, Ragtime, a show very near and dear to my heart, The Scarlet Pimpernel, The Woman in White, Sunset Boulevard, Aspects of Love, and he's also a singer-songwriter and has three solo albums, including the 2019 release Legacy, which is now available on Spotify and Apple Music.
Okay, enjoy the episode.
Sandra and Ron.
Hey.
Hi, guys.
Hi, it's Lauren Clayton.
Oh, great to talk to you guys.
Hi, Lauren Clayton. How are you?
We're doing good. How are you guys?
We're excellent, actually. We're having a lovely morning coffee right now.
Oh, fabulous.
I'm like, it's 12:30, Ron.
Theater folk.
Yeah. It's theater morning.
We're still on the theater schedule.
We are. We haven't had a job in months and months, but we can't break the schedule.
It's ingrained in us. That actually is a good question, because I've really tried to retrain myself, you know, going from I was performing 8 shows a week in New York pre-quarantine.
You were doing that.
Yeah.
Your own show. That's so cool that you were doing that.
Thanks. Yeah, it was exciting. And, you know, I was going to bed at 4 a.m. and waking up at 11 or noon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, now I've really tried to retrain myself. But how have you guys fared in that respect?
No, I mean, I thought, and you know, you live in LA as well. And I thought when we moved out here, because we live in San Diego now, and I thought we moved out here, well, we'll just sort of shift the schedule. So now we'll be getting up at, you know, 7 a.m. or whatever. Nope. I mean, we just literally just transferred the whole thing, and it's still 2 a.m. is bedtime for me.
What do you guys think about that from a health perspective? Because I know they say you're supposed to, ideally, rise and set with the sun, kind of. You're supposed to have an earlier sleep and wake schedule. I've never been able to train my body to do that.
Me neither.
Well, we have talked to Dr.
Michael Bruce.
Michael Bruce, who's a sleep expert, and he kind of has this concept that everyone is a different, we're all different type. What is it called?
Chronotype.
We all have different chronotypes.
Right.
And some of us are wolves, some of us are like the night owls. So maybe it is natural that you guys are that.
Yeah, well, Clayton and I took, there's a quiz on his, it's like chronotypequiz.com or something, and we both got bears, which means like your ideal bedtime is like 11:30 and you want to wake up around 7:30.
Wow.
But, you know, but there are like the wolves who, you know, their ideal bedtime is like 1 a.m. or something. Huh. I was surprised I actually wasn't more of a late nighter.
I want to take that quiz. That's awesome.
I'm kind of like that I'm identifying with a wolf right now. I think that's, you know, pretty cool, actually. So,
so we're just throwing this, you know, like we're just gabbing because we're all theater people and we know the secret connection we all have together. Laura and I met doing a play in Los Angeles where I played Neil Simon. And
I played Toulouse-Lautrec, among others.
We became friends and started doing a carpool. And I was kind of like dealing with a lot of like major health issues. I was coming out of a major depression, which like this show kind of brought me out of.
Same, actually.
And I was, I literally had like arthritis and my hair was falling out and all this stuff. And I was dealing with health problems. And Laura we kind of bonded on some of those issues, and she became my health coach during that.
Because I had just graduated from the Functional Medicine Coaching Academy, which my mom started. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Clayton was essentially my first client.
Wow.
And, you know, the rest is history.
Wow. That is so cool.
Yeah, so that's how we, like, came together to do this podcast, which essentially is about functional medicine, but we started saying, and beyond, you know, so we're not just talking to, like, doctors and scientists the whole time. Tell us about you guys and how y'all are involved in theater and how you got started and all that.
Well, I mean, as an item, I guess, as you know, Sandra and Ron, I mean, our biggest connection, it would be Phantom of the Opera. And Sandra is the longest running leading lady in Broadway history, with the longest run as Christine in Phantom of the Opera. And that is actually how we met doing that show. We met on the national tour of that show where I came in to play the Phantom at the Kennedy Center. But we're both Broadway actors.
I guess I'm a former Broadway actor.
Yeah.
Because I've transitioned, gosh, 10 years ago now, more than that, from Broadway into speaker author land. So I'm a keynote speaker who sings, which I didn't know there was such a thing, but
you wrote a book, Unmasking What Matters.
Yeah, 10 life lessons from 10 years on Broadway. And, you know, we could all share our life lessons from what we've learned doing what we do. And 10 years in one show was a kind of a unique lens. And because so many people are familiar with Phantom, it's really led me to be able to do something that I love, actually even more than I loved playing a character in someone else's story.
I love that. And the that transition.
And that's a quote from Chess.
Theater people.
All right. I started singing it in my head as soon as you said it. Okay, so let's just focus on Phantom then, because Phantom, as we know, is a lot of people's first musical that they see.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, it was mine, actually.
It was mine, yeah. Too. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the only musical people, like, will ever see.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think Phantom, the story of Phantom of the Opera, resonates so strongly with people, and it has run for as long as it has?
I've thought a lot about that question because I've seen it, you know, from standing on that stage more than 1,000 times. I had a lot of time to think about what is it that's making this powerful connection with audiences all over the world. And one thing for certain is the music. I do think there's something, even from a vibrational frequency point of view, that has an impact on people. Physiologically, Kristen Blodgett, who's the musical supervisor for Phantom and many of Andrew Lloyd Webber's shows all over the world, she talks about how that music really transcends language. And even if people aren't necessarily getting all the words, they're being impacted by it. But from my perspective, what I think the real piece, the biggest point of connection about that show to me has to do with the character of the Phantom and the metaphor that the show hangs on, which is this person who feels that they are somehow fundamentally flawed and need to, that it's about a person who needs to cover himself, feels that he needs to cover himself up with a mask, that if I show who I really am, I will be rejected. And I really believe that when Christine shows him unconditional love by the end of that play, it touches something so deep in the human psyche that we're not even necessarily aware of it. But that story of learning that we are lovable exactly as we are, learning that we are worthy, even with all of our perceived flaws and inadequacies, I think there's something universal about that, that so many of us feel we are somehow not okay exactly as we are. And the arc of that story points to that we are indeed all worthy of love and acceptance exactly as we are.
Amen. Mm. So something we talk about on the podcast lately and that I've really been thinking about a lot is resilience. And I think that actors have a very specific kind of experience when it comes to resilience because we get told no a lot. And interestingly enough, the more you're kind of like the more you get known and the more, in my experience, the closer you get to something, the more no's you're going to start getting. So how have you guys been able to kind of manage all of this, the no's and all of the rejection, and still be able to maintain like a positive aspect on life and on theater in general?
Wow. That's such a powerful question. And I think it is a process. You know, there's not an answer to that question. It's like, aha, that's solved. Now I never worry about that. I think that's something you're constantly working on. But you know, there are a couple things, and I know they sound like cliches, but one of the first things I think I learned early on in the business, because I've been doing this for 30 some years now, is I had to kind of come to terms with the fact, because you get so many no's, you get so many things that you think, you know, you'll Example I often give is that I was up for Marius in the original production of Les Miserables, and literally down to the wire, like it was the day before the show was going into rehearsals, and I was in casting calls for that.
Oh my gosh.
And I didn't get it. And it was devastating. It just, you know, just rocked my world that I couldn't do that. However, 3 years later, I was playing Andras in the company. I was a different role, you know, and that turned out to be the right role for me. So there was, you know, I think that the lesson in it all was you're probably never going to be doing what you think you're going to be doing. But, you know, but this is it, but it's a ride. It's life is an adventure. And if we stay open to the possibilities of what's out there, it's very, very rewarding in that sense. That was something that made it always easier for me to not always be thinking, oh, well, I should be doing this or I should be doing that, but rather just stay open to, well, why do you want to do this in the first place? And for me, just the artistic fulfillment of creating roles, whether it's a role I thought I was going to be playing or a role that I never expected playing, the Phantom was one I honestly never thought I would play. I just thought I don't see myself in this role. And even though I auditioned for it many, many times, when I finally did get it, I was still shocked. I couldn't believe that it happened. And it took me a while to actually find my doorway into where's the me in this role. But when we learn that lesson and when we start to go, oh, well, when you find yourself in the role that you've been cast in, there's always a new growth and opportunity there that keeps you on the track of, oh, this is my own, I'm running my own race here. This is my own adventure. And I think that's true for every individual actor.
That's a big piece of it too, is sort of in some ways we all have to keep the blinders on and run our own race and not fall into compare despair where we're looking left and right and seeing what other people are doing. And now with social media, it's more challenging than ever. There's always some way, no matter how successful you are, there's always a way in which you can make yourself feel less than, or that you're not enough or not doing enough or not getting the breaks that somebody else is getting. And we also have to, it is a cliche, but it is really true that it's never personal. When we don't get the thing, it's never really about who we are. It has nothing whatsoever to do with who you are as a human being. You are talented and worthy and perfect for something, but this might not be the thing you're perfect for, or the timing might not be right. I think it requires everything we have in terms of grounding ourselves, getting really present, and recognizing that who we are and what we do are two different things. And to really practice everything we know in terms of mental health and staying confident and happy when sometimes it looks like it's never going to happen for me. I had a 5-year plan when I moved to New York that I was going to see if I could just earn a living doing something I love. 4.5 years into that 5-year plan, I was couch surfing, like living on my friend's sofa. So basically homeless, could not even afford a sublet, and rejected all over the place, working temp jobs and really about to give up, thinking it is never going to happen for me. And it turns on a dime. You just never know when the opportunity is coming. And so we have to hold on to our faith and trust and hope that things are working out for us for the highest good of all concerned. That's always my constant prayer is like, let things happen for the highest good of all concerned. I really hope I'm the one that's going to get the part, but if not, something good is coming. You got to hold on to that.
Yeah. And, and just to put a little capper on that, you know, Sandra and I, one of the things that we bonded over early on when we met was we're big Indigo Girls fans. And
yes,
the song Closer to Fine, one of the great lyrics in that is, you know, how does it start? The best, one of the things you taught me is not
the best thing you've ever done for me. The best thing you've ever done. Take my life less seriously.
It's only life after all. And yeah. You know, and there is this sort of sense, and I know that, you know, when you're dreaming about doing a Broadway show or doing a movie or to film and you don't get it. Sure. It's not always easy to hear that, but it does help to, I always think of it with the idea of like, if you can be a camera pulling away from your life and pulling literally out into outer space and seeing how big everything is around you, it does give you the perspective to go, life is far bigger than this one thing I'm focused on, this one no, or yes, as the case may be, and to just see the larger arc of all of it is it gives you peace and brings your sense of humor back.
Yeah. Yes, zooming out. I constantly am trying to remind myself of that when I get sort of lost in the minutia of something.
Yeah. Right. So something that I always think about when it comes to acting, and now we're just going to talk about acting, and I know that people will relate if we just are more specific to our own stories. But when it comes to any type of work you do as an actor, you're always kind of, the first thought people have is like, what do they want from me? What you're like, how do they want me to do it? You know, like,
how do I fit into their picture?
To their picture. And it seems like from most stories I hear with actors, it's not until the actor steps into their own kind of like essence and brings their own personal touch to a role or a character that's when things start happening for them. Mm-hmm. So I know that you probably both have had a similar experience. So we'd love to hear a little bit about that.
It's absolutely true. And it's the most essential thing. I literally just taught a masterclass for the Broadway Mentors program, BroadwayMentors.com, which is a great bunch of really, really awesome Broadway people from many different walks of that range. And my talk was essentially subtitled Playing the Part of You. Because in the end, that's where we're headed. You know, the most authentic thing we have to offer the universe is ourselves. And I think you're absolutely right that we're so often trying so hard to you know, say, what do you want me to be? I can fit into this or I can fit into that. You might remember the movie Tootsie, where Dustin Hoffman is losing his mind in an audition, where they're saying, you know, we don't want you. He said, we're looking for somebody taller. He says, I can be taller. I can put lifts in. I can be shorter. We're looking for someone younger. I can look younger, right? I've got age makeup on right now. And finally they say, we're looking for someone else, okay?
but I love that movie. You know, I think
once we do embrace that we have the most original thing, you know, and that's sort of the challenge of it. But it also, once we embrace it, it's very freeing to go, oh, well, they're just looking for something else. You know, and that measure mark of when they are looking for someone else means that at some point they are literally looking for exactly you, you know. And I also think it's very freeing to walk into any audition going, you know, look, you're there to solve a problem. You either can or you can't. Absolutely, you want to do your best. Absolutely, you want to give your best to it. But many times those things are for ourselves and not really for this mysterious unknown bunch of people behind the table. It's the satisfaction of knowing we gave our all. And then we have to release it. But I'm constantly working with young actors. I'm just constantly reminding them, look, your essence is what is called for here. And the more in touch you are with that, the better your work is going to be. It's going to come from a true place. It's going to come from your human experience.
And I want to add too that this is really the point of connection from our world of theater into the world of everybody and whatever you do for a living. Right. A huge piece of what I speak about in my keynotes to business people is this very same idea that your essence, your authenticity is the point of connection between you and your clients. But people are always looking for the ring of truth. They're looking for that essence. And whether that means vulnerability or just being more of who you really are in your work, it's often not the products and services that make people buy what you're selling. It's you. It's your essence. And I think the more we can embrace that, I mean, authentic leadership, authentic business practices. It's becoming more important than ever now, especially with Zoom, and you have these big shot CEOs, but their kid is running in the room and you're seeing them in their environment and mm-hmm. the dog's walking by. I don't know if you can hear right now, but we have a puppy and he's starting to whine a little bit in the background.
This is so cute.
He's great. And he's starting to say, mommy, daddy, pay attention to me. But authenticity really is what connects all of us. And it's our gold. So just to be more and more of who you really are is going to bring success, I think, in no matter what you do.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I love that it does kind of feel like our industry and our world is leaning so much more in that direction now. I was just watching I love the TV show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Yeah. And I was watching the finale last night. And, you know, in that time, in like the 50s and the 60s, there was so much about performers and people in general that was hidden and was all behind closed doors, and you couldn't really share, you know, who you really are. Mm-hmm. And I love that more and more it's like, no, tell your real story, be who you are. And if it's messy, great. We don't care. We want the mess.
We love it even more. Yeah. I mean, my book is called Unmasking What Matters. And I say that really the whole point of the whole thing is it is the unmasking itself that matters the most. The more we can drop the mask and embrace who we really are and bring more of that forward, the freer we become and the more we connect with people, which is one of the things that makes life so rich.
But that's kind of the thing though, like because we're all bogged down with all this, you know, social media and all this stuff, and we're all presenting different ways and trying to be perceived different ways. I feel like sometimes if someone was like, what's your essence? What's your true self? And I'd be like, I don't know. I forgot. So do you have any tips for ways that people can kind of like reconnect with that part of themselves?
Yes, it is really challenging to do that publicly, to maintain a sense of your authentic self, your essence, while trying to communicate that publicly over an Instagram post or something. And I remember reading that the writer Anais Nin refused once to write a bio for a magazine that wanted to do a big feature on her, because she said her reasoning was for fear that my sincerity will be mistaken for pretense. I think creating a public persona that we put out into the world, whether it's through our website or through our social media posts, is a very different thing than coming home to yourself. And one of the things that's essential for me is alone time, quiet time, away from screens, away from trying to be on in any way, so that I can just listen to my inner voice, listen to my heart, what lights me up, what brings me joy. That's when I connect with who I really am, apart from trying to be on display for the world, just to sit outside on my patio and watch the hummingbirds come by and feel my heart swell, to look at the sky, to look at the trees, go for a walk, get quiet, get centered, and remember, oh yeah, this is me. This is my connection with everything that's bigger than me. That's when I remember, if you think about that word, it's like to put ourselves back together, to remember who we really are.
Yeah, that's so great. Also, in Emojiland, we also deal with this theme a lot, like outside versus inside, because emojis have like fixed codal identities that define them. And so how do you wrestle with what you look like on the outside versus who you are inside? Right. And so in terms of like mental health, what's going on inside, you know, maybe that's not always, you know, doesn't coincide with the mask that you're wearing that people see. How do you guys deal with mental health, especially during this time?
Yeah. Therapy helps.
Yeah.
Therapy really helps. I've become such an advocate of it, because you know, we have our friends and we have the people that we talk to. We have our partners that we talk to. But, you know, it really is important to sort of dismantle, especially right now. I mean, you know, unprecedented. How many times do we hear that word? And yet it's so many moments of everything we're going through right now on so many levels. It's unprecedented. It's more, my therapist is fond of saying, we're not built to handle everything that happens to us in the world. We're just simply not built for it. And we have to, you know, we have to find ways to process all of this stuff. And especially right now, it's crazy. I mean, you know, as we record this, we're on the brink of a world-changing election. You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. There's so many massive things that are going on that are a lot to process. You know, social unrest to the tune that we have never seen in this world. And you know, it really, really helps to have a conduit for processing that. That's an overview. Sandra would better to advise you on specific things.
I could go on and on and on about it because my default setting without any practices in place is despair. So I've had to really learn. And like you mentioned, Clayton, you struggled with depression and I've depression, anxiety, overwhelm, all of it. Those are my go-tos. So I have really had to focus a lot of energy on finding my center. And I know you're both into positive psychology and that's part of your training, Laura. And that whole practice has helped me tremendously. One of the things that is essential for me, it's a non-negotiable, comes from the work of Dr. Rick Hansen. I've read most of his books. And his practice of taking in the good has really, literally been life-changing for me because we are all so programmed, as I'm sure you both know, about the negativity bias in the brain. Evolutionarily, we evolved to pay more attention to negative input than positive. So taking in the good means I train my brain every day to look for positive experiences and really marinate in them to take at least three breaths. When I am noticing that I'm feeling good or something, I see beauty or I'm experiencing a positive emotion, I try to consciously let that get bigger for myself to balance the scales of negative and positive. I also know from Rick Hansen's research that cultivating positive emotion intentionally actually helps us perform better, mm-hmm. whether it's on stage or in anything we do. So cultivating a sense of gratitude, appreciation, positivity, love. I'm a big fan of loving kindness meditation, and the kind that I practice involves thinking about someone you love, what you love about them, and then sending them the traditional positive wishes. And you include yourself in loving kindness meditation. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm and suffering. May all beings live with ease. And just really trying to build up positivity, positive emotion in my life has been incredibly important for me. And physical activity, movement is, I just finished reading Kelly McGonigal's wonderful book, The Joy of Movement, which has absolutely nothing to do with losing a pound or building muscle. It's all about just the physiological and psychological benefits of movement. And the research is so clear that the more we move our bodies, the better we feel emotionally. So those things are just non-negotiables for me.
I love that. And I love also relating it to theater. If you're in the middle of a performance and you start thinking about all the things that went wrong in the first scene, you know, you're dead in the water. Yeah. And I mean, I speak for myself. I know that I've found myself in that mindset at times, and I've got to get out of it because then, you know, you're going down.
Yeah.
Oh, Laura, I was so adept at making my list of wrongs after every show of what I could have done better that I actually forced myself to start doing a practice of writing down five things I did well.
Yes.
After a show, what went well? And the first might be I showed up. You know, I didn't hide, which I've wanted to most nights.
So I just have to know, because we have two pros here, and it's great to be reminded that like things can go wrong, even on a Broadway stage where this has been done hundreds of times. Can we just hear like one of your, and I don't want to focus on the negative, but it's going to bring me positive joy to hear it. I want to hear like some like worst thing that's happened on stage. I just have to know.
That is a popular question, I think, for all actors, because you truly, you know, we began this by talking about, you know, you try to stay in the moment. And, you know, I love the meditation, the simple meditation of just be here now. Be here now is so great for actors. And you know, and yet it's one of the most challenging things to do when so much can happen out of your control. And this story is about a show that I believe Laura and we have in common, which is Ragtime.
Yes, I saw that, and Clayton was in it as well. So we definitely want to talk about Ragtime.
Yeah, well, I played Father in the Broadway revival of Ragtime, one of the final sequences of the show. It's before Mother sings her big song, We Can Never Go Back to Before. And it's a scene that takes place on the beach. And it's very, very tense, you know, dark, dark, cloudy skies. And Father is going to New York to volunteer as a hostage to end the crisis at the Morgan Library, which is it's being held hostage there by Cole House and his gang. And for all the right reasons, they need to get attention to their cause. And so Father is going off, you know, essentially maybe never to return. And things have been very, very stressful between him and Mother. And it's a tense, tense scene on the beach. And their son is there. And their son is holding Cole House's baby. So it's, you know, here's this baby in the boy's arms. Now, of course, we don't use real babies on stage. That doesn't really work. So he's holding a mannequin of a baby. And it's very tense, and Mother and Father are fighting, and Father's got to leave. And Mother says to their son, Edgar, who's holding the baby, says to Edgar, go say goodbye to your father. And Edgar walks up to me with the baby, and he says, goodbye, Father. And I hear, what was that? And the audience starts howling. And the baby's leg has fallen off. Fallen onto the stage, and there's a baby's leg lying on the
stage. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
And it, what do you do?
What do you do?
What do you do? There's a leg on the stage, and the audience is howling, and, you know, so, and we've got to recover this thing so she can sing this, you know, Tony Award-winning song, We Can Never Go Back to Before. So I literally just wait for the audience to calm down a little bit, and I bend down, and I pick up the leg, and I tuck it inside the baby's waddling, and I pat the boy on the head, and I say goodbye, Edgar, and he takes the baby off stage, and we continue. And the audience applauds, you know, but it was one of the most challenging moments of my life, because I'm a pushover. I will laugh at anything that happens on stage. And my co-star was Christiane Knoll in that, who was Tony nominated for her performance. And she was, I credit her steel as an actor for helping me get through that the loss of that child's limb on stage.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wow.
Well, because you can have that moment where you're like, okay, the audience is laughing. Do I want to tag this with something to get more of a laugh or stay true to the
story?
To the story. Right. And like, so that was it.
And it was tempting. I mean, you know, your brain starts to go to that. Is there a funny response to this?
Right.
And even when I tell the story, I'm tempted to come up with some line that, you know, didn't really happen. But it the fact of the matter was, is the greater good there is that, you know, you preserve the peace. You want the integrity, you know.
And you're setting up your partner for her song.
Right.
And we share a phantom story that we tell all the time, which I'll let you tell about.
It doesn't top the baby's leg.
But it, you know, like the what would happen to us frequently would happen in the show sometimes is that, you know, you have this famous scene in Phantom that's built about around a gondola that's going downstage, and the gondola is operated literally like a toy car. There's a guy in the wings with a big box and a remote control stick, and he drives it by radio control. And sure enough, you know, one night that boat just came to a screeching halt. And, you know, so what do? You know, and Sandra and I found ourselves in that situation. And so we looked at each other and I offered her my hand and she stepped out of the boat and we walked on water downstage and left the boat down at the back. You know, what do? You just have to continue on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go Jesus. Yeah.
Wow. Another role you played.
Another role I played.
Really? I played.
Yeah, in the Book of Mormon, he was Jesus until COVID. Actually.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. But so you two are actually, I believe, the first couple that we've spoken to on the podcast. Wow. So as partners in life, and you met, correct me if I'm wrong, you met doing Phantom, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Right. So how do you support each other as a couple of performers? And, you know, I know that Sandra, you've sort of transitioned into being more of a speaker now, but how does that work?
Oh, that's such a great question. We love that. We really are each other's biggest fan. So that helps. It helps when you genuinely just think your partner is so amazing and you just want to see them thrive. Ron really, I mean, without Ron's support, I could never have made the transition that I made from Broadway to speaking and writing a book and all of that. And he just held my hand through it and shored me up when I felt all the self-doubt in the world. And I think one of the things that's been essential for both of us in our partnership is that we really try to see what the other person is wanting to create. And we support that, whatever their real earnest desire is to become more of who they are. That's an absolute yes. And an absolute, we cheerlead for each other on that journey, whether or not it has anything to do with making money, which yeah. As artists, often the things we really care about doing are not the things that are going to make us a lot of money.
Yeah.
They might cost us money. But it's important to us to accomplish these things, to express what's inside of us.
We both have sort of watchwords, you know, like you talk about a mission statement, you know, people have a mission statement or whatever. And I don't know that I can clearly say what my mission statement is, but I always think in terms of, like, for me, integrity rides above everything. I just, anything and everything I do in the world, I want to do with integrity. So Sandra knows that, and anything I'm working on, whether it's with, I'm writing a song for one of my new records, if I'm developing a role for an audition or a role that I'm playing, whatever it is, or whether I'm teaching, I always want to make sure I stay within the range of the integrity of it. And she's the best sounding board for that. She always looks at it and says, you know, here's a place where you have a, you know, you're coming up about against a boundary. Here's a place where you can go further, but always with the nurturing love of, like, seeing the person that you love more in the world wanting to succeed at what matters to them because it matters to you.
Yeah. So basically, you're saying live with a life coach.
I'm not a life coach.
You're not a life coach. Okay. Well,
I don't think, you know, I mean, even though, you know, I gave an answer that I do think sounds life coachy, I guess.
No, that was a great answer.
But I do think it ultimately just comes from, you know, we see each other with so much, and I really don't mean this to sound corny in any way, but, you know, when you're really in love with somebody, you see them with such infinite possibility, you know, so we see beyond the other person's, you know, self-doubt and all the things that we all struggle with. So, you know, there's this just sort of gentle fanning of the flame, I guess, is what it is. Mm-hmm. But not, you know, yes, it does fall into a life coach kind of place, but it's more, it just comes from love initially. It just comes from this place of just going, I want you to blossom into what I know you see and what I see for you, you know?
Yeah. I think we're really fortunate that our foundation is always coming back to building each other up, not in an egocentric way or a way that's a, what?
I can't stress enough what Sandra was saying about, you know, it isn't always about, oh, this is going to make $1 million or, oh, this is going to do, you know, we're terrible business people. We're really not all that interested in whether something sells or not as much as that it sort of meets our mantra of what we want it to be in the world, you know, and as a representation of our values, you know, so that in that way, that's born out of this great love that we have for each other. And so we just sort of kind of keep fanning that and sort of help be the, you know, the bumpers on the side of the boat that just keeps it safe as it sails to its ultimate destination. That does sound life coaching. Nice. And I apologize.
I love that. Then the image of fanning the flame is like, yeah. I love that. Like yeah. One time I heard someone talk about love as just someone sitting on a porch with a harmonica in their mouth, just breathing in and out. Mm. And that's what love was to them. Just this flow in and out of like the sound of a harmonica. That's my
that's
yeah.
Beautiful.
And almost like, you know, to take that even a little further, it's just like that person is just sort of gently nurturing a melody. Mm-hmm. Just sort of coaxing just maybe a little bit more out of it. Just a little bit more and giving it a safe place to, you know, resonate in the world. And I think, you know, we're getting very poetic now, but I do think that's what we try to do for each other is just sort of be the safe place for that melody and just encourage it enough to get to more ears, so that, you know, if we are creating something that's going to be public, that we instill confidence to continue to create, to continue to develop. And we're incredibly lucky that we can do that for each other. You know, it's, which is not to say that we don't also disagree and then fight about things.
Absolutely.
And say, you know, I don't think you should do that, or I don't think you should say it that way, you know, but we always do try to return to that place of just sort of gently fanning the flame to create a, you know, it's scary to make any kind of art or to put anything out in the world and be risky. And, you know, you want your partner to be, Stephen King always talks about Tabitha as his IR, the ideal reader. And I think, you know, we try to always be each other's ideal reader or ideal audience or ideal listener in that regard.
And give each other helpful feedback. Yeah.
Well, that was a question that I was about to ask. So within, for the listener, for within kind of like the performance world, when you're working on something, there's this whole portion of rehearsal, which is called notes. And that's just where someone gives you notes on your performance.
Right.
And I've always been interested in how people take notes and how people receive notes. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious the two of you, how are y'all good at getting notes from someone, or are you a little more repellent like I am?
Repellent.
That's great.
Sandra's far better at taking notes than I am.
I am exemplary, if I do say so myself. I really have. I've always been a big sponge. Like, give me more.
And, same.
And I take direction really well. I love taking direction. It's like my favorite thing. If you give me something to play with, I'm like, let me out there. Let me at them. I want more and more and more feedback.
Yeah.
It just feels like freedom to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It feels freeing to me.
Yeah. And my life's journey is to get to that place, and I am not there.
Very fixed, very big opinions.
Okay.
And that's been challenging for us with each other in giving and receiving feedback, learning how to take feedback from each other without, you know, getting defensive or.
Yeah.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
And not just from each other, you know, but, you know, it's the real learning and the real journey is to, you know, for me, because I tend to, my default is, well, I made that choice, so it must be right.
Mm.
which is ego and a lot of other things going, you know, and I do think we should defend our choices, but we should not sink our teeth into them. That only, you know, that only gets in your way. And I know that about myself and about my work and all those other things, but it is a struggle, almost as if it was an instinct, and you have to break that instinct and say, okay, put down the bone. You know, we're training a dog right now, so the thing that's in my mind is drop, put it down, and see if there's another way. And then when you embrace that other way, you might be, you know, inevitably, you're going to end up on a journey that takes you in directions that, you know, you never expected. One of the greatest notes I received, one of the roles that I did was I played the Scarlet Pimpernel. I took over that role from Douglas Sills and then played the role on Broadway and then also played it on the national tour. And late in my work on the show, I'd been playing the role for over a year. And one of the original stage managers came in on the show, who I had not worked with previously, came back to the show. And he gave me one tiny adjustment. And it's simple. I'll just say it right now, you know, but in terms of, he said, you know, I think something to remember with this character is the way that he deals with things is that he always comes from a positive. So even when he receives bad news, his brain is going to a place not of, oh my God, that's horrible. And what am I going to do? He's not going into a tragic place. He's going into a positive problem solving place. And it was a simple little thing, but it completely changed the character in such a remarkable way for me. And all of a sudden, my final weeks in the show took on this whole new value that I wish I'd thought about or known at the beginning, just because I opened myself up to the possibility of doing it differently. So, you know, there's great, great value to be gleaned from taking other people's opinions in and absorbing those notes. And honestly, at the end of the day, it's the job. You're supposed to take notes. It is not your job to do what you want to do. It is your job to preserve the integrity of the show. And Laura, as a writer, I'm sure that rings very true to you if someone's playing a character in your play and they're insisting on going down a path that you just is completely contrary to what you wrote. You know, sooner or later, you're going to have to say to them, this isn't what the play's about, you know? So I think there is, you know, real value to be gained for setting your ego aside. And one day I will get good at that.
No, but it's actually, I think, very interesting and relevant because there is that moment and it's the reactive moment where you kind of get in this reactive space and it is a little primal because you just take it personally sometimes. Yes. I've gotten to a point where it's more like, I just kind of take, whether it's a good note or a bad note, I just don't react to it. I write it down and revisit it later. And then I can be like, oh, that actually, you know, like then I can really hear it. I just need to take that little time away from it.
Yes. Yeah. We've learned where, you know, and my first instinct when I get a note is, oh, that must be right. That's got to be right. Because I guess, you know, I'm very impressionable and, you know, and I'm really learning to really tap into my gut instincts of what I think is right. And that's one of the things I'm trying to focus on right now in my life, because I think for a long time, I was someone who only looked outside of myself for those answers.
Oh boy, do I relate to that, Laura. Yeah, that's 1,000%. I was so sort of green and impressionable when I got Phantom. And here's Hal Prince, who's to me a god. And I'm like, well, everything he says must be perfect. And I, you know, and I believe that he was right. I mean, the thing is not broken. I did not want to be like, I have a way to make this show better. No, it's a tried and true thing. But I think you're really onto something there in terms of listening to our inner voice, as well as the feedback coming from outside. And also, Ron, as you were speaking about how in your long run with Pimpernel, that note helped to free you and give you something different to do.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I think that I say I take notes so well is probably the fact that I did one show for 10 years and anything that was given to me that would change it up for me was welcome.
Right.
Right.
Like, oh, thank God I have something new to try. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, on that subject of like keeping something fresh, what are some tips you have? Because I mean, you did Phantom for over 10 years. How do you keep telling the same story over and over again and keep like reinventing it at the same time?
Well, it's probably, you know, aligned in many ways with what your listeners are all practicing for themselves. And Ron, you use the Ram Dass, be here now. It really is the same thing we try to practice every day in our lives, to be in this moment, right here, right now, not in the past or in the future. It's a practice of presence that is incredibly challenging, but also really enlivening, because even though I'm standing in the same spot on the stage, I'm singing the same words that I've sung literally a thousand times, I've never done it before, right here, right now, with this audience, with this particular body of the feelings that are happening in me today. So that practice of absolute mindfulness and presence served me on stage and continues to serve me off stage. And the other thing that I always return to is to remember why we're there. Really become aware and bring to mind what it's really about, which in many ways has nothing to do with us. It's about the people who paid that money and took time out of their lives to sit there, and what it took for them to get there and be in that audience. A dear friend of mine, when I was in my 10th year of Phantom, gave me a priceless gift. He knew I was feeling some burnout, and he invited me to coffee, and he handed me a purple box that he'd stenciled the word perspective on top of. And inside the box were clippings he found on the internet from people all over the world sharing their experience of seeing Phantom and talking about the memories they created or the impact that the show had on them. And it really served as a reminder for me to shift my perspective every time I'm going out there, that, oh, here's this man who saved up for a year to take his kids on a trip to New York to see the show. And he's watching his daughters watch me up there, watch Christine, watch, you know, people creating memories that will last them a lifetime. People get engaged when they're out there, you know, on the night they saw Phantom. There's so many incredibly moving stories. And that helped me reconnect to the purpose behind it. I think it's so important for all of us to remember the meaning of what we do, to keep that perspective that this matters. What we do matters to someone out there. And that's the most motivating thing in the world, when we have a sense of purpose behind what we do.
Yeah. And just a technical standpoint, from the actual work of doing it over and over again, a metaphor that I like to think of with it is, you know, this goes a bit, Clayton, to what we talked about taking notes. You know, there are boundaries, and your job is to live within those boundaries. Keyword being live. So it's a little like a coloring book where, you know, you have that same black and white image at the beginning of every day, but you do have some latitude in terms of, well, maybe it's not going to be this shade of red today. Maybe it's going to be that shade of red. So I'm always looking for those little minute differences mm-hmm. that you can bring to just keep it true. So not choosing a different shade of red just because I'm bored with that shade of red, but what is a truer shade of red? What is a truer shade of blue? Well, you know, I'm being very metaphorical, but the idea always being, is there a new way to serve the truth of the piece, staying within the lines, but bringing it to life in a newer way. And that for me always sort of helps keep it fresh. I mean, I did 7 years of Book of Mormon, and I tried to always color a little differently every single night if possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with my limited experience with repetition in a show, it's always when you get to the end and you're like, oh my God, I did it. And it felt fresh. Mm-hmm. That's always like the shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the gold, right? That's when you go, wow, you know, that because you've given yourself the gift of giving a fresh performance, but you've also given the audience the truth of an absolutely honest right. performance.
Yeah. And what we focus on, you know, how we use our attention is everything. And if we tune the instrument of our attention in a certain way, we can always find something fresh. We can always find something new. I might hear a sound in the orchestra that I'd never heard before if I'm really paying attention. And the same is true in our lives. Here we are, so many of us trapped inside our same four walls for way more of the time than we've ever had to be in one place before. But it's all about how we use our attention. And if we're focusing on what is fresh and new and beautiful about this moment or this day or this person sitting across from us, we can always find some goal.
Absolutely. We were just talking about this William James quote, "Our experience is what we attend to," in the positive psychology episode. I just love that quote, and it's so true. It's what are we focusing on? And wherever we're shining that light, that's what's going to be illuminated.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Very absolutely.
True. So we could keep talking forever, obviously,
yes.
but we want to be respectful of time. So I do want to talk a little bit about purpose, because you mentioned that earlier, Sandra, and especially for actors and performers, but it's not just actors and performers. Many people have had their jobs and, you know, like the thing they love doing kind of taken away from them in this moment. And that kind of, you know, especially for theater people, like we don't know when it's coming back. So how do you handle, I know it's true for theater people, is we put purpose in what we do. It's part of our identity. It's part of like our lives. It's part of our soul. How do you maintain a sense of purpose if you feel like your purpose is taken from you? And then secondly, how can you find new purpose if your old purpose is kaput? Did that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Sandra, you seem to be comfortable in this new thing that you're doing. So do you miss acting?
Yeah. Oh, I love you for asking that. You know what, Clayton? The biggest thing I learned from all of that quote-unquote success is that we are so often looking down the road to once I get that thing, once I become whatever, or have a certain number in my bank account or a certain title after my name, whatever it may be, then I'll be happy. Then I'll feel okay. Then I'll have the confidence I've always lacked. Once I lose the weight, or, you know, it's a thing. It's such a thing of if then. And the biggest thing I learned from that success was that it didn't bring me the things that I thought it would. I was still, you know, as Ram Dass said, no, it's not Ram Dass. It's as, Jon Kabat-Zinn. Jon Kabat-Zinn's book called "Wherever You Go, There You Are." That's what I found out. Oh shit! Here I am, the longest running leading lady in Broadway's longest running show, and I'm still me. And I still have all the same insecurities. Now they've just morphed into imposter syndrome. I am no different than I was before. And this is where I think a lot of people fall into things like addictions and drugs and alcohol and whatever, because once you get the prize and you go, and my friend Janine Roth, author of many books, including Women, Food, and God, she has taught the world that so many women in particular hang their happiness on the number on a scale. And the biggest misconception they have is once they lose the weight, they recognize, oh no, I'm still unhappy. That didn't solve all my problems. And I certainly thought if I ever made it to Broadway, I would be a different person mm-hmm. somehow. And it's just not true. So what I got from that was, oh boy, if happiness and freedom and well-being isn't out there, it must be in here somewhere. It was a fundamental shift in identity from external to internal, as we've been talking about. And this is where I speak about the real unmasking, you know, in my book and in my talks, is once we recognize that we really do have everything inside of us we need in order to be whole, and that can never be taken away, no matter what befalls us. If jobs are stripped from us, if relationships end, if health crises come upon us, our fundamental worth and well-being is untouchable. And once we really connect with that and know it, and how do we get there? I don't know. We all have to find a personal practice of coming home to who we really are. And I believe there is a doorway for all of us. It's really there. Nobody can give you the one key that's going to unlock it for you, but you can find it. And once you recognize that your fundamental worth is absolutely unaffected by anything outside of you, then you're home free. And do I forget that on occasion? Yes, absolutely. And have to go back to my practices to remind myself. But I do know that that is ultimately the truth. I believe that for every single human being on this earth, that you are 100% worthy, regardless of the job you may or may not be doing. And our purpose, yes, is to become the freest and fullest expression of who we are. And that involves doing things, but at a being level, recognizing that we're human beings and not human doings. And there's nothing we need to prove or produce or fix in order to be whole. I think that is the piece that is really hard to stay in touch with in our very capitalistic society that's all about go, 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 bigger, better, more, do, produce, earn. Everything in our culture trains us to look outside of ourselves for our sense of well-being. And that, to me, in my experience, was a treadmill that just kept speeding up and I never got anywhere.
Yeah. Amen.
Amen.
Get off
the hamster wheel. Yeah.
The hamster wheel. That's a better yeah. use of it. Yes.
Yeah. And interestingly enough for me, I mean, because, you know, like I told you before, I mean, I did 7 years of Book of Mormon, and that was touring. And as the tour got longer and longer, the engagements got shorter and shorter. We started doing, you know, we'd sit in a city for 8 months, then 3 months, then 1 month, then 1 week, then 1 week, then 1 week, then 1 week. It started to be where we were constantly moving, constantly packing, constantly changing venues. And that hamster wheel is just zoom, 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 zoom. You're on flights every week. You're in airports. You're in, you know, social chaos. And then suddenly the world comes to a screeching halt and silence. And you know, for all of the four of us all involved in the performing arts, complete silence where you can't be in front of an audience, where the work that you did does not exist. It was a huge thing and is a huge thing. Where I am now on that same journey that Sandra just described of going from like this hamster wheel spinning and then screeching halt and trying to decipher what's my identity minus these things that I was, minus this role, minus this job. Who are you? Well, I'm in the show. That's not who you are. Who are you? Well, I, you know, singer, actor, dancer. Well, those are things you do, but really, who are you? And we've had this, all of us, every person listening, we've had this long stretch of time to maybe have that question echo in the more silent part of our lives now. And I'm only just, it's been what, 7 months now, only just beginning last month to relax into that silence and to actually start to have some answers to like, oh, I do think I know what my identity is. And it wasn't that show or this show. And, you know, we perpetually are asking ourselves this as performers, as actors, My identity isn't who I am on social media. My identity isn't those things. It's something much smaller and much quieter, but something that I'm learning to love a lot more in its intimacy. And it's been one of the great gifts of this time, of this, you know, this time that has taken a lot. My daughter's actually started writing songs too. And one of the songs that she's written is called For All It Is Not. Which is about for all that this time is not. And then it begins to list all of the wonderful things that this time has become. And one of the lessons for me is getting a better sense of how wonderful it is to have a smaller and quieter identity.
Beautiful. And a smaller and quieter life that doesn't involve so much running around. And that is, I think, the gift that many people are finding from this time. It's torture for some people. Typically more extroverted people, I believe, are having a much harder time with this. But for all of us, boy, is this an opportunity to say, what really matters to me and where can I find joy? And that's one thing that I would encourage all of your listeners to start paying attention to is when you, I like to think of bookending the day in the morning and the evening, like literally when you're in bed, when you first wake up, before your feet hit the floor, what am I grateful for right now for this day? And how do I want to experience this day? And then at the end of the day, when your head hits the pillow again, to say, where were the moments of joy? When today, what were the best moments of my day? Where did I experience any kind of, it doesn't have to be a big joy. It could be like a quiet moment of peace. Did I have any sense of well-being today? And where was that? Start to pay attention and put those dots together. And we can start to carve out a path for ourselves that really lights us up from the inside out and has less to do with putting on a mask and performing and being outwardly directed, but to really start taking direction from within.
Love it.
I love this intention, mindfulness, staying in the moment, shifting perspective. Thank you. You both are so inspiring and powerful speakers, both of you. So this was really an honor to get to talk to you guys today.
The pleasure was ours. Thank you. It was so much fun.
Yeah, we really could talk to the two of you for hours and hours.
I know we could.
We have so much in common, and we're all on the same parallel track, I think, with trying to just be creatively expressive and maintain a sense of well-being and a joyful life and hopefully do some good in the process. So thank you both for all that you do for people.
Okay, well, we like going to San Diego, so just don't be surprised when you hear the...
We gotta meet this puppy.
Let's have coffee together.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you guys sing together just at home at all?
People ask us that sometimes. We never, ever, ever do.
People will say, if my partner could sing like that, we'd just sing to each other all day long. We just like songbirds. And Sandra actually doesn't particularly like the sound of my voice.
That is not true. That is absolutely not true.
I'm loud. I sing very loud. And he tends to say, can you just take that upstairs and
he has a booming baritone voice.
Right.
It's stunning, but when it's right next to you in your living room, it is powerful. It is. No, we really only sing when we're working on something.
Yeah.
And we're practicing, and we don't really want an audience
right. When
we're doing that, so we can hide anyway. But we do perform together a lot, and from our living room now over Zoom, and we've been doing some concerts and keynotes virtually, which is bizarre.
Yeah.
So there is some singing going on in our living room, but only when it's
necessary.
When there's an audience other than
right.
the two of us. And,
I will say though, I mean, you know, because mainly her career has taken the shift to keynotes, you know, and then with, you know, with the pandemic and everything, there was a bit of a break where there weren't a lot of keynotes and things. And she did have one again recently, and now more and more beginning to come up again. And I always really love hearing the sound of her voice again, not just her voice, as a singer, of course, which, you know, I really, there's just something really magical about that, that always just brings me back into this fantastic place of love and appreciation of who she is. But hearing her voice as a speaker too, you know, it's a wonderful thing that we have in relationship with performers, anybody that's in relationship to it. But I think you feel it in anything, to get to watch the person you love do what they do and really stand in their power is remarkable. And so getting to hear her do that as a singer, as a speaker, as whatever, always really gives me a better day somehow.
Aww. Aww, I love that. Amazing.
I believe this is the first podcast interview we have ever done together. Is that true?
I think you're right.
This is our first podcast.
Yay.
I thoroughly enjoyed listening to you, Cher. I really have.
Well, thank you. And likewise, I've heard you do numerous podcasts, but I think this is the first one we've done together. Yeah.
Thank you, Laura and Clayton, for giving us a chance.
Yes.
We're so honored.
Okay. And the last question is, what did y'all name your puppy?
Oh, his name
Rocky.
Is Rocky.
Rocky.
Yeah. Cute. All right.
Happily, he went back to sleep, so we're going to let him snooze away in his crate a little while.
Yes, keep it off.
Get a break.
All right. Well, thank you again, and y'all have a beautiful day, and we can't wait to talk to you soon.
Yes.
Sounds great.
Bye.
Bye.
Take care.
Sandra Joseph and Ron Bomer. What a duo.
What a pair.
They're so great.
Yeah, and if they're listening to this right now, they should just start a podcast.
They should.
Yeah, because they're like, it's so cool y'all are doing a podcast. I'm like, y'all should start a podcast.
Yeah, interview us.
Interview us on your podcast. But it was funny, like, off mic how you looked. You gave me this, when we did that interview, you looked at me and you were like, we should ask them to sing. And I was like,
no.
I just don't, I mean, not that they said they would or wouldn't,
right.
But like, that's, you know.
I know, it's like, I wouldn't like if someone just
no, like, I don't like when someone's
like, it's like, can you sing
or someone's like, oh, you're a comedian, tell us a joke. You're like, that's not really how it works.
Not what I'm here for.
But not me, like, I'm always ready to go.
I'm always in good voice.
I'm always in good voice, and you can ask me to do anything, and I'll do it on a dime.
That's right, whatever you need, I'll do it.
Whatever you need, I'll do it. Here's my headshot,
I'm
here's my
gal.
Resume, and here's the link to my latest picture.
It's going to be a hit.
Anyways, I love talking to them.
Yeah,
I love their
too.
Energy. And
great reminders. I love what she was saying about that purple box with the word perspective on it.
Perspective.
It's
and
like, yeah.
Just for any actors listening, it literally always is about the audience and who's watching it later. That's all that matters. Like, yeah, you want to get a good experience. You want it to feel good. And like, you know, you want to get your emotional turmoil out or whatever. But it wouldn't matter unless people were watching it. So that's just a fun reminder.
Yeah, totally. Right? Yes, absolutely. All right. You know what time it is?
What the health is that?
Okay, so today's what the health is tapping.
Like Broadway,
it's like,
tapping?
We're going to do a time step. Shuffle off to Buffalo. No, tapping. Another kind of tapping. We were talking a little bit about this recently, like tapping when you're tapping your chest.
Oh, right.
Like energy healing.
Energy healing through tapping. Yeah, yeah. I've tried it before.
Like professionally, or you just tapped yourself?
Just tap myself.
Oh. Okay. How'd that go?
it actually was cool. I mean, I think from what I know you're going to give me the rundown, but from what I know, what it does do is it just kind of grounds you and puts you in the moment, puts mm-hmm. you in the now. So you get out of your headspace, you get out of the negative thoughts. So for that, it was helpful and useful.
Yeah. And kind of on brand for what we're talking about today,
right.
Staying in the moment. But it's actually called Emotional Freedom Technique, EFT.
Mm.
And it's an alternative treatment for physical pain and emotional distress. It's also referred to as tapping or psychological acupressure.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So people who use this technique believe that tapping the body can create a balance in your energy system and treat pain. According to its developer, Gary Craig, a disruption in energy is the cause of all negative emotions and pain. So a disruption in energy. That's interesting. Like, is negative
mm-hmm.
emotions and pain.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. I think about, like, you know, you're going along your day, everything, you're like, everything's going to be fine. And then all of a sudden, disruptor,
mm-hmm.
you know, oh, I got a parking ticket or whatever.
But if you just...
Yeah, tap your way through it.
There's some ASMR.
Yeah, that's nice. Okay. But tapping, it's been used to treat people with anxiety and PTSD. And, I mean, it's similar to acupuncture, where it, like, focuses on these meridian points or energy hotspots. to restore the balance to your body's energy.
Cool.
And it's believed that restoring this energy balance can relieve symptoms that a negative experience or emotion may have caused. And it is a Chinese medicine practice.
We should have someone on to talk about like acupuncture, tapping,
we should. Cupping. Yeah, because it's all very interesting stuff.
And
anyway, but it has these five steps. The first step is identify the issue. So you have to, in order for this to be effective, you actually have to identify the issue or fear that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So that then that's your focal point while you're tapping.
Okay.
And then number two, test the initial intensity. So after you identify that problem, then you need to set a benchmark level of intensity. So like from a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the worst or the most difficult, and then this scale will assess the emotional or physical pain and discomfort that you feel from your focal issue.
Okay.
And then three is the setup. So before you start tapping, you have to establish a phrase that explains what you're trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
So acknowledging the issues and or accepting yourself despite the problem.
Okay.
So the common setup phrase is, even though I have this, insert your fear or problem, I deeply and completely accept myself.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Step four is EFT tapping sequence. So essentially like the methodic tapping on the ends of 9 meridian points. And there are 12 major meridians that mirror each side of the body and correspond to an internal organ.
Wow.
Yeah. The eyebrow is the bladder meridian. Well, I mean, this is fascinating stuff.
Anyway, this is like a crash course.
I know it is. And then step five, test the final intensity. So at the end of your sequence, rate your intensity level back on, again on that scale from 0 to 10. Compare your results with your initial intensity level. So if you haven't reached 0, keep tapping.
I love it.
Yeah.
So mine would be, even though I can't stop crying, I accept myself for who I am, or something like that.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
That's what you want to do.
Yeah,
do it.
Good.
All right. Well, that was our episode. As always, a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Like and subscribe and leave us a comment because it makes us feel good.
Yeah. And then we don't have to tap our day away.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
All right. Until next time.
Goodbye.
What the Funk is recorded at the Lab Studio in Los Angeles.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Functional Medicine Coaching Academy. Want to get involved in the movement that's transforming healthcare? Check out functionalmedicinecoaching.org to find functional medicine stuff for patients, doctors, coaches, everybody.
Boldly searching for your next used vehicle? With CarMax, you don't have to settle on anything when it comes to your ride. Instead, steer clear of the ordinary and buy the car that's right for you. Because CarMax makes it easy to stop settling and find a car you'll love today. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.